Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another live edition of the Global Reality right here on the Global Reality Radio Network with me, your host, Josh Reeves. It is the Wednesday edition of the broadcast. May 16th, 2012 into Thursday, May 17th, 2012. Thanks for being with us. My website where this broadcast originates from is theglobalreality.com. That's theglobalreality.com. You'll find everything up there pertaining to my work, links to listen to the stream, archive shows, all my documentary films, including The Secret Right Volume 2, which is available on Blu-ray and DVD that exposes the phony Patriot movement and the whole deal there. Definitely want to get a copy of that for your collection if you don't have one. And all the ways to support our work up there. My newest film I'm working on right now is the Lost Secrets of Ancient America Volume 1. And we need your support to be able to complete this film. We have a long way to go on our budget, and we got to meet the budget by the end of the month. And if we don't, the film's off. That's just the way it is. So please help us out if you can. Going to see if we have any emails to get into tonight. I don't think we do. Seems like I had one. This is Josh. After listening to your show the other night, I heard you say that Quetzalcoatl, Jesus, Horus, and other gods like men are the same characters, just reincarnated into new bodies. With that said, I found that the Prisca Theologia carries the same concept that all religions are derived from one divine concept. Was just wondering what your thoughts are on that subject. By the way, dude, I totally support the idea of a pay-per-show concept piece. Yeah, we're probably going to be going to that as soon as I have the money to get up off the ground. I have to have, it's going to cost me so much to do it. But yeah, we'll probably do like 1 hour. It'll be like 1 hour on the stream, and then you'll have to pay $2 to get the rest of the episode. That's probably how I'm going to end up doing it. Yeah, I have a choice, really. I'm not going that way yet, but I probably will be going that way. My thoughts on the subject are really just that. What I talked about the other night, I really don't have anything else to say on that subject. But I will have a lot to say on that subject in my new film. So wait till that's out to get my opinion on it. All right, let's see. Let's get into the news then. This is just priceless. Apparently the feds are all scalded because somebody outed their op for Underwear Bomber 2 Electric Boogaloo, starring Robert S. Mueller as Turbo. I guess yeah, they're all pissed about this now. I mean, these guys run these ops with these phony terrorists that are their assets every time, and then get mad when somebody reports the truth. And I promise you that the fact that they've tried this twice, remember, they tried to blow up the World Trade Center once, too. Remember that? The fact that they've tried this twice tells me that at some point they're going to be successful with it. It's going to be important that we remember all these times where it's absolutely proven that that this traces back to them. FBI Director Robert S. Mueller III today disclosed that the FBI is investigating leaks to the news media about the recently disrupted plot by Al-Qaeda's Yemen affiliate to smuggle a bomb designed to be concealed in underwear onto a U.S.-bound jet. The plans for the attack, which feature a more sophisticated version of the device the underwear bomber of Christmas 2009 was arrested with, were first revealed by the AP, but a day later, it was revealed that the individual at the center of the plot was a double agent working for Britain's MI6 Secret Intelligence Service and the CIA, along with Saudi Arabian intelligence assets. "We have initiated an investigation into this leak," Mueller testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee on Wednesday. "Leaks such as this threaten ongoing operations, puts at risk the lives of sources, and makes it much more difficult to recruit sources and damages our relationship with foreign partners." Listen to this crybaby. "Well, this makes it so difficult for us to be able to fool the public into believing terrorists are real. Come on, guys, get with the program. Why are you making it so hard for us to fool you?" I mean, it's unbelievable, the balls of these people. Boy, lively crowd tonight. Man, I'm just feeling the love tonight. God, it feels like a fucking... Is there anybody even out there listening? Let's check the streams. Feels like a fucking morgue tonight. Man, what is the deal? What is the energy? I don't know. Something weird is up. I had a fucking... Last night before the show, I had a migraine. I had a migraine all through the show. Had a migraine all working. I never get migraines. I just felt bad. And I'd forgotten that... I didn't really connect it, but earlier in the night, last night, a friend of mine had asked me to get her some water. And it's this Topo Chico Mayan water. You ever heard of this? I've seen it several times, and I just was like, man, I'm not buying that. That's water from Mexico in a bottle. What's the first fucking rule of Mexico? Don't drink the fucking water. Right? I went to Mexico once to go to the Mayan pyramids. The only time I've ever even been on an airplane, didn't get to even go because as soon as the airlock opened, my guts went gurgling ass, dude. Like as soon as you got your fucking dysentery, had to pay $50 and go to a shitty Mexican hospital, have them pump me with an IV. Get my fluids back up so I could get back on the plane and go home. Well, it sucked. Montezuma's revenge from breathing the air. I didn't even drink the fucking water. So I tried some of this water the other night and last night, and it tasted good to me. But I had this migraine, and it was about 7 o'clock this morning. Decided to go to sleep, which is, kind of early for me, really. 2 hours later, I woke up feeling like I'd been asleep. Or 3 hours later, I woke up feeling like I'd been asleep for 10 hours. And I still got, splitting migraine, and my blood pressure was going up and down. I was going from hot, sweating hot to cold, like cold sweats. Straight up Montezuma's revenge, dude. Went and puked and felt fucking fantastic. But went back to sleep and was good to go. But, yeah, I think I'm probably the only guy in history that could catch a case of Montezuma's revenge without even going to fucking Mexico. It's terrible. Traces of aspartame? I don't know. It's mineral water. It tasted great, but goddamn. I got a case of the Montezuma's revenge just from fucking drinking some water. Is ridiculous. Aviation authorities are scratching their heads over a mysterious flying object in the skies above Colorado that almost caused a mid-air crash. The object was sighted by a commercial jet pilot who claimed to air traffic controllers that some kind of flying craft got too close for comfort on Monday. I guarantee it was one of those silver orbs. I guarantee they were spraying chemtrails that day. In a transmission that appeared on liveatc.net, the operator of the Cessna Citation 525 CJ1 says, a remote control aircraft or what? Something just went by the other way about 20 or 30 seconds ago. It was like a large remote control aircraft. A spokesman for the Federal Aviation Administration, Mike Fergus, told Nine News, that it's working to get some answers and that if the pilot's story is true, such an object can be extremely dangerous. I guarantee it was an orb. I see these flying around commercial jets all the time. There's tons of footage of them flying around commercial jets. There's footage of them making crop circles, and there's footage of one flying underneath the first flight they ever did of the Concorde back in the 70s. And there's footage, you can see this thing just fly right underneath the Concorde and just hover there. Those are still being seen to this day. You see them a lot around chemtrails. And probably some sort of probe from somewhere. Scientists turned to Alaska over fears active fault line could cause Japan-style tsunami that could devastate California and Hawaii. Scientists say a fault line running across Alaska could cause tsunamis of the same magnitude as the Japanese disaster of March last year. Attention is turned to the Alaskan Aleutian Subduction Zone, a region where one of the Earth's tectonic plates carrying the Pacific Ocean drops beneath the North American plate. A particular section of the fault near the Sumeti Islands has not ruptured since at least 1788, and measurements on this area, which lies 4 to 5 kilometers underwater, reveal the pressure is accumulating rapidly. In the Pacific Ocean, plate slips has happened in the geophysically similar Tohoku subduction zone off the coast of Japan. A tsunami could occur, and the deaths could happen as far away as Hawaii and California. According to Discovery.com, scientists are now investigating the underwater fault line in hope of estimating the likelihood of danger in the to the U.S. and to the Hawaiian Islands. The last time a slip between the Alaskan plates occurred led to the Good Friday earthquake on March 27, 1964, which was the powerful... It should say most powerful, not which was the powerful earthquake in the U.S. in U.S. history. No. You guys don't even know how to write. Which was the most powerful earthquake in U.S. history, a 9.2 magnitude earthquake, which led to 145 deaths. Tsunamis also occurred in this area in 1947 and 1957, with a magnitude 7.4 earthquake occurred in the area last June, but as its location did not lead to a tsunami, a brief tsunami warning was recalled shortly afterwards. Many of these deaths happened hundreds of miles away from the epicenter of the earthquake, with 90% of the deaths caused by tsunamis. The Japanese quake, which measured 9.0 magnitude, led to a 10-meter-high tsunami and ended up killing an estimated 18,000 people. Televangelist Jim Baker, known best for losing his multi-million-dollar empire amid a sex and embezzlement scandal, is building his new brand. Around the end of the world. Yep. Well, what have I always called Jones and all those guys? Infovangelists, man. That's what they are. They took the televangelist route and changed it around and spiced it up with some conspiracies and fear-mongering of a different kind with a less religious overtones. And infovangelists. So now he's taking a nod from the people who took a nod from him, and he's getting into the, huckster business. By the way, I saw Michael say something in the chat earlier. I thought you were saying we should start. I think I misunderstood what you said. I think you were talking about digging for something and finding some gold somewhere to fund the broadcast. Yeah, that'd be fantastic. But I would never sell gold here. Let's just be clear about that. But point is that Jim Baker now, I guess, has resorted to selling fear-mongering products for the end of the world, and he's probably getting his stuff from the same Khashoggi-owned dealer that GCN and everybody else, all the other networks out there, get theirs from. The disgraced pastor is now selling pricely cordless generators and survivalist food packs on his website in an effort to help earn money to pay off his debts to the IRS. You know, is that what this is all about? Is that what these guys, that's what these guys get into this stuff, isn't it? They get radio shows and make movies and yell and scream so they can pay off the IRS, huh? The most unusual item on the docket are the collection of enema kits for sale. Perhaps in a nod to his late wife, Tammy Faye, who died died after a long battle with colon cancer in 2007. That's just fucked up. Why would you even put that in an article? You think him selling enema kits has something to do with Tammy Faye Baker? That's messed up. God, these people say I'm fucked up. That's the most fucked up thing. I mean, why would you even try to make that connection? Clearly, there's not a connection. I mean, I don't know. I don't know what the connection is with survival stuff and enema kits. I mean, I don't know. I mean, that's, you know. When you shit yourself with fear, you need a Jim Baker enema pack. I'm Hulk Hogan. I approve of this message. Baker made headlines in 1980 when he and his wife, Tammy Faye, took the airwaves by storm with their Christian evangelical broadcast development of the Praise the Lord television network. So, there you go. Selling huckster, Jew gold, and snake oil for the Lord. Boy, I hope you got more than a gift card for that one, buddy. Military-grade rocket launcher exchanged for grocery store gift card during Mother's Day gun buyback in Los Angeles. A weekend gun buyback event in Los Angeles has yielded some unexpected weaponry, including a pair of rocket pistols and a military rocket launcher, sans rocket, that were turned in for gift cards. I'm going to come down here and get my gift card here again. Just hit this rocket launcher laying around over here. Yeah, I got plenty of them anyway. I might go down and donate, get me a gift card to the grocery store. I'm going to trade this in to get $50 worth of GMO food down here at the Walmart. I'd have bought your rocket launcher off of you, dude. You know what I mean? You didn't have to trade it in for groceries. Shit. As part of the program run by the mayor's Gang Reduction and Youth Development Office, Youth Development Office. Really? If you guys got youths running around with rocket launchers in L.A., you got more problems than I thought. Individuals can turn in their firearms and ammunition anonymously with no questions asked. In exchange, they receive $200,000 worth of Ralph's grocery store gift cards or Visa prepaid cards for varying amounts, depending on the gun type, up to $200 for assault weapons, and up to $100 for handguns, rifles, and shotguns. Officials hope that hosting the buyback on Mother's Day would prompt more people to trade in their weapons. And this is, I mean, this is, number one, I mean, I've talked about this a million times. I've covered these stories before. I mean, we all know why this is fucked up. I mean, you know, that's how stupid people are, trading in guns for Best Buy gift cards and grocery store gift cards. And, you know, if you ask me, the only way that you're ever going to get gun control is to do it exactly how they do it. Now, you can pass laws all day long. People are just going to revolt, and you're going to have problems on your hands. But if you collapse the economy and create artificial inflation on everything, well, hell, I'll tell you what, you know, you can get like what you got in this picture here, which is just stacks and stacks and stacks of guns. But, I mean, this is how they're going to round up the guns. To get everybody into such a state of depravity that they have no choice but to start, you know, selling off family heirlooms and everything else. And that's what neo-feudalism and this neo-feudalist system is all about. The haves and the have-nots. And in the future, it'll be, you know, That's how they want it to be. They want it to be so the, you know, the quote unquote 1% can own all the guns. And if you're not one of those people, then you can't have a gun. Sorry, Jack. That's just funny, though. At least you could give them something better, you know? Is the Earth actually a living creature? Chemical clues could finally prove claims our planet is a single organic system. In the 1970s, James Lovelock and Lynn Margulis claimed that Earth's physical and biological processes linked to form a self-regulating, basically self-aware system. Their book became a cult classic, and the idea that the Earth is a giant chemical system, almost like an organism, persists to this day, although it's never been proven. I mean, look, come on. It's pretty obvious. Everything's one system and interconnected. Look at some of these different mushroom and fungi growths, and they create neural networks. I mean, it's insane. Now a new chemical clue, sulfur, could allow scientists to work out whether Earth is in fact alive, a huge chemical system that in turn sustains us all. The Gaia hypothesis doesn't claim that the Earth is actually alive, but that all living organisms and their non-living surroundings are bound together into a system that maintains the conditions for life. One of the early predictions of Lovelock's theory, known as the Gaia hypothesis, was there and there should be a sulfur compound made by organisms in the oceans that would transfer to the air and thus to the land. Scientists are on the brink of testing this theory and placing the existence of at least part of one of the systems of the Earth. The most likely candidate for this role was deemed to be dimethyl sulfide. Harriet Duru of the University of Maryland has created a tool for tracing and measuring the movement of sulfur through ocean organisms, the atmosphere, and the land in ways that may help prove or disprove the controversial Gaia theory. Sulfur, the 10th most abundant element in the universe, is part of many inorganic and organic compounds. Sulfur cycles sulfur through the land, atmosphere, and living things and plays critical roles in both climate and in the health of organisms and ecosystems. Dimethyl sulfide emissions play a role in climate regulation through transformation to aerosols that are thought to influence the Earth's radiation balance. Not to mention the aerosols are spraying there. But, the reason they've kept this information suppressed as long as they have is because they don't want people to be up in arms about the raping and pillaging of the resources of this planet. That's bottom line. Dig this. This ties right into the research and stuff that I've been talking about lately about, you know, pushing the dates back on everything that we've been told. And that's something that people are going to have to get used to, is that, you know, everything is much, much older than we've been told it is on our planet. The Rhine is 5 million years older than first thought. Age of the river corrected based on fossils. The Rhine is not an unknown entity in Europe. On its journey to the North Sea, it flows through Switzerland, Austria, Germany, and the Netherlands. In addition, the catchment area of the river, which is around 1,233 kilometers long, also encompasses almost all of Luxembourg, as well as small parts of Belgium, France, Liechtenstein, and Italy. Yet, as famous as the river may be, its original age is still disputed. Up to now, it has been assumed that the Proto-Rhine is around 10 million years old, explains Professor Madeleine Bohm, leading author of the study and head of the HEP Working Group, Terrestrial Paleoclimatology. But based on our examination of fossils from a site near Spreadington, we now believe that the river is at least 5 billion years old. The mammalian fossils in the Spreadington and Eppensheim areas have been considered for 200 years by vertebrate paleontologists to be the yardstick for the neogene, the time span between 23 million and around 2.5 million years ago. The sites became famous around the world for the first ever discovery of a fossil ape. and the first scientific descriptions of 19 large mammal species in the early 19th century. So there you go. There yet again, pushing it back, pushing that date back farther and farther and farther. Observations from NASA's Wide Field Infrared Survey Exploratory, WISE, have led to the best assessment yet of our solar system's population of potentially hazardous asteroids. And here they are bringing this asteroid meme. Remember what Wernher von Braun said? First it would be communists, then it would be terrorists, then it would be asteroids, then it would be aliens. Potentially hazardous asteroids, or PHAs, are a subset of the larger group of near-Earth asteroids. The PHAs have the closest orbit to Earth's, coming within 5 million miles, and they are big enough to survive passing through Earth's atmosphere and cause damage on a regional or greater scale. The new results come from the asteroid hunting portion of the WISE mission called NEOWISE. The project sampled 107 possible hazardous asteroids to make predictions about the entire population as a whole. Findings indicate that there are roughly 4,700 PHAs, plus or minus 1,500, with diameters larger than 330 feet. So far, an estimated 20 to 30% of these objects have been found. While previous estimates of PHAs predicted similar numbers, they were rough approximations. NEOWISE has generated a more credible estimate of the object's total numbers and sizes. The NEOWISE analysis shows us we've made a good start at finding those objects, but that truly represent an impact hazard to Earth. But we have many more to find. Yeah, give us more money. Always got to have that new threat, because if you don't have that constant threat, then you can't justify your spending on, you know, weapons. And that's what they want to do with this. They want us to believe that there's an asteroid threat so they can weaponize space and control it. And then once they get it under control, well, then they have space supremacy with space-based weapons. You try to get off the plantation of their global order, you get zapped from space with a fucking laser beam. And that's what they want. And why do you think our DOD's been spending more on space-based weapons in the past 10 years than they ever have in the whole history of them? Today's mega forest fires of the southwestern United States are truly unusual and exceptional. In the long-term record, suggests a new study that examined hundreds of years of ancient tree rings and fire data from two distinct climate periods. Researchers constructed and analyzed a statistical model that encompassed 1,500 years of climate and fire patterns to test, in part, whether today's dry, hot climate alone is causing the megafires that routinely destroy millions of acres of forest, according to study co-author and fire anthropologist Christopher L. Roos, Southern Methodist University, Dallas. The researchers found that even when ancient climates varied from each other, one hotter and drier and the other cooler and wetter, the frequencies of the year-to-year weather pattern that drive fire activity were similar. The findings suggest that today's megafires, at least in the southwestern U.S., are typical, according to Roos and co-author Thomas W. Sweetum, the University of Arizona. Furthermore, the findings implicate that the cause not only modern climate change, but also human activity over the last century. Well, I thought this was going to be interesting. So what's the point of this article then? I thought the point was going to be, do we know these fires are being started from humans? You had to cut an old tree to be able to tell that? Yeah, we cut down this old tree and we came to determine these mega fires being caused by humans. Really? You had to do all this scientific analysis of a goddamn tree bark to be able to tell that? I don't know, man. This science shit is a bunch of cockamamie horse shit sometimes. Boy, this is a good one. This ties in right with what we've been talking about. Skeletons found at mass burial site in Oxford could be 10th century Viking raiders. 37 skeletons found in a mass burial site in the grounds of St. John's College may not be who they initially seemed, according to Oxford researchers studying the remains. When the bodies were discovered in the grounds of the college in 2008 by Thames Valley Archaeological Services, archaeologists speculated that they could have been part of the St. Bryce's Day Massacre in Oxford, a well-documented event in 1002 in which King Æthelred the Unready ordered the killing of all Danes living in England. However, a new research paper led by Oxford University has thrown up a new theory that the skeletons may have been Viking raiders who were captured and then executed. The skeletons were found in the ditch of a previously unknown Neolithic henge monument during excavations. They are mostly of men aged between 16 and 25 who were robust and taller than average. So these are, I was about to say, are these giants? And they absolutely are giants. But here they just say taller than average. Right. Well, when you look at the average height, you know, in 1002, people didn't get it, you know, under you know, about 5 feet. It was kind of the average. So 6, 7, 8 feet, yeah, that's above average. The skeletons were found in the ditch of a previously unknown Neolithic henge monument during excavations. There is evidence that each individual was stabbed many times shortly before he died, and severe wounds show that they were brutally slaughtered. Some of the men also appear to have older scars, which could suggest that they were professional warriors. There is also evidence of charring on some of the skeletons, showing they may have been exposed to burning before burning before burial. Research from the Research Laboratory for Archaeology and the History of Art at the University of Oxford carried out a chemical analysis of collagen from the bones and the teeth of some of the individuals and concluded that they had a substantial amount of seafood in their diet. It was higher in marine protein than that found in the local Oxfordshire population as recorded in existing data. So they were most likely seafaring people. Yep, there you go. Testing was done and using strontium isotope analysis of tooth enamel, a technique which provides evidence of where an individual lived when the tooth formed. Strontium, a naturally occurring element in rocks and soils, is absorbed by plants and animals and can be found in trace amounts in mammalian teeth. Strontium isotopes reflect the particular geological conditions, so every trace can be revealing of an individual's location. They also looked at data relating to previous research, in which an isotopic analysis of dismembered skeletons found in a burial pit at the Weymouth Ridgeway in Dorset identified the individuals as Scandinavian Viking raiders. The decapitated skeletons in Dorset dated between 890 and 1030 AD and were thought to be a group of young men from different countries across Scandinavia. The isotopic analysis of the Dorset group and the individuals found in the mass burial site at St. John's College show similarities. Lead author Professor Mark Pollard, director of the Research Laboratory in the School of Archaeology, said, "Our latest research suggests that it is possible that the grisly remains at St. John's College are the outcome of the documented massacre at St. Friedswide's Church in AD 1002. Evidence of knife wounds and the burning of the bodies are consistent with the story of the burning of the church. However, following the chemical analysis of the teeth and the bones, we are presented with an alternate interpretation that they could have been a group of professional warriors rather than a group of residents of Danish origin who were later rounded up and massacred." Yeah. So that's interesting stuff there, huh? Evidence stacks up that the monolith at Gardam's Edge is astronomically aligned. Well, yeah, join the club. What is it? Researchers at the Nottingham Trent University have gathered new evidence that a 4,000-year-old monolith was aligned to be an astronomical marker. The 2.2-meter-high monument located in the Peak District National Park has a striking right-angled triangular shape that slants up towards geographic south. The orientation and inclination of the slope is aligned to the altitude of the sun at midsummer. The researchers believe that the monolith was set in place to give symbolic meaning to the location through changing seasonal illuminations. Dr. Daniel Brown presented findings on the 27th of March at the National Astronomy Meeting in Manchester. The rare example of a monolith is located at Gardam's Edge, a striking milestone grit ridge less than an hour's drive from Manchester. The researchers have carried out a microtopography survey of the surface surrounding the monolith, and their findings indicate the presence of packing stones around the base of the monolith, evidence that it was placed carefully in position. They have also carried out 3D modeling of illumination of the stone through the seasons, adapting for changes in Earth's tilt to the ecliptic plane over 4 millennia. The landscape surrounding the stone harbors many ancient monuments such as Bronze Age roundhouses and late Neolithic enclosure and other traces of a long-lasting human occupation. The researchers believe that the stone is also late Neolithic, set in place around 2000 BC. Given the sensitivity of the site, we can't probe under the surface of the soil. However, through our survey, we have found a higher density of packing stones on one side, supporting the case that the stone has been orientated intentionally. The 3D modeling shows that during the winter half year, the slanted side of the stone would remain in permanent shadow. During most of the summer half year, it would only be illuminated during the morning and afternoon. Close to midsummer, it would be illuminated all day. The researchers are currently backing up the model by gathering contemporary photographic evidence of the stone. The stone would have been an ideal marker for a social arena or social gathering. Oh, yeah, it's just social things, yeah. No importance. Those just silly, bored people back there in history. They were bored. They had no TV and, you know, they didn't have anything for entertainment, so they just built shit aligned to the stars. Now shut up and go watch TV. We have the stream bill coming up due tomorrow. Our goal for this week for fundraising is $300. Please act accordingly. TheGlobalReality.com. Chip in there with a chip in banner and help us. We got to pay the stream bill to keep it going tomorrow. So please help us out there. And we also have the chip in banner there for the film. We have to reach that by the end of the month. We have the donate button. We have the Amazon gift list where you can go through there and get something that we need for the film or the radio show. P.O. Box, we absolutely can't use PayPal. We're going to take a break, come back, and get into our series of reading tonight. This is The Global Reality. Stay with us.
Holding man seems as to where I feel, yeah. What we've got here is failure to communicate. Some men you just can't reach. So you get what we had here last week, which is the way he wants it. Well, he gets it. I don't like it any more than you.
Your women crying, look at your young men dying, the way they've always done before. Look at the hate we're breeding, look at the fear we're feeding. Lives we're leading the way we've always done before. Peace could last forever. And in my first memories, they shot Kennedy. I went numb when I learned to see. So I never fell for Vietnam. We got the wall of disease to remind us all that you can't trust freedom when it's not in your hands. When everybody's fighting for the promised land. Restore in that breath. I don't need your civil war. face you're feeling. Look at the blood we're spilling. Look at the world we're killing. The way we've always done before. Look in the dark we followed. Look at the leaders we followed. Look at the lies we've swallowed. And I don't wanna hear no more. Civil about war anyway.
Uncensored, no holds barred talk. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. This is the Global Reality Radio Network.
Back here with you on the Global Reality, right here on the Global Reality Radio Network. I'm your host, Josh Reeves. Thanks for being with us here tonight for another late night Moonbat edition of the broadcast. In this segment of the broadcast, we're going to be continuing our series of reading from our new book that we recently started, Lost Worlds of Ancient America. Tonight we're going to be getting into some stuff about the Back Creek inscription, which is something that's that I'm hoping to go get footage of, located where it's at. It's very interesting, and I'm going to be tying all this stuff in the new film that I'm going to be working on. TheGlobalReality.com is my website, and we don't have outside sponsors. We have no outside. We had a sponsor for a month. Didn't last long. We have no outside sponsors. We have no outside source of income at all for the work that we do here, and we rely completely on the generosity of our listeners and the people who enjoy what we do. So if you enjoy what we do and you want to see this continue and you want to see this new film come out, please go to theglobalreality.com and either make a donation for the operating costs or for the film budget right now. Either one would be great. Please help us out if you can. TheGlobalReality.com. We have the stream bill coming up due tomorrow, so we definitely need some help. Thanks. Chapter 3, Tennessee's Ancient Hebrew Inscription by Scott Walter. Since its discovery by Smithsonian Institution archaeologists more than 100 years ago, the Bat Creek Stone has been the subject of heated debate. Although it is officially condemned as a transparent hoax by establishment scholars, independent investigators wonder if it might constitute wrongfully neglected evidence of first century AD Jews in North America. And that's, it's inappropriate to call them Jews. These are Semitic people. Okay? And that's, you know, that falls back into that old line of that distinction that people don't know. What we're talking about here is Phoenicians, Canaanites, Amorites, whether they be Muslim, whether they be Jewish. You understand, Jewish is a faith. It's not a race, but people still always refer to it as a race. The argument was finally settled by scientific testing published for the first time in Ancient American September 10th issue, Volume 14, number 88, this report presents the results of a microscopic examination of the physical and geological features of an archaeological artifact called the Bat Creek Stone that American Petrographic Services Incorporated performed at McClung Museum on the campus of the University of Tennessee in Knoxville on May 28, 2010 and June 29, 2010. The scope of our work was limited to, number one, performing petrographic observations using reflected light microscopy and microphoto documentation on the artifact. Number two, performing scanning electron microscopy analysis. And number three, conducting a document review of the Smithsonian Institute field report written by John W. Emmert, who discovered the artifact on February 14th, 1889. American Petrographic Services Incorporated transported its microscopic equipment to the museum where staff members Registrar Bob Pennington and Museum Director Jefferson Chapman graciously provided access to their facilities and the artifact. Present during the examination were Dr. Barbara Duncan, Education Director at the Museum of the Cherokee Indian, Sharon Littlejohn, Eastern Band of Cherokee Indian, and Leslie Kalin, Eastern Band of Cherokee Indian, because this was found on Cherokee Indian land. And they believe that they have, that their ancestors were Semitic in origin. And they would be correct in that assumption. On June 29, 2010, American Petrographic Services included returned to the Science and Engineering Research Facility at the University of Tennessee to complete the examination of the artifact using the scanning electron microscopy equipment on the campus. The Bat Creek Stone was discovered by John W. Emmert in an undisturbed grave mound. And by the way, they found this thing in a mound. Number three of the three mounds found together along the Little Tennessee River near the mouth of Bat Creek in 1889, Emmert was working on behalf of the Smithsonian Institution's Bureau of Ethnology's Mound Survey Project and reported to his immediate supervisor, Cyrus Thomas, a U.S. ethnologist and etymologist prominent during the late 19th century for his studies of the natural history of the American West. Thomas originally identified the Bat Creek inscription as Paleo-Cherokee. In 1964, it was brought to the attention of a Chicago patent attorney, Henriette Mertz, who discovered that a photograph of the object had been erroneously published upside down by Washington, D.C.'s Smithsonian Institution, the nation's foremost repository for anthropological and archaeological materials. She additionally suspected that the characters inscribed on the object were not Paleo-Cherokee, but Phoenician. Ding, 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 ding. Tell her what she's won, Johnny. In 1971, the inscription was described as Paleo-Hebrew-Judean from the Roman era by Dr. Cyrus Gordon, an American scholar of Near Eastern cultures and ancient languages. Much has been made by previous investigators of earlier correspondence between Emmert and Thomas relevant to the former's supposed struggles with alcoholism and suspicions that he forged the inscription to curry favor with Thomas. Because we have discovered no direct evidence to support these allegations, which cast doubt on the veracity of the discovery, we dismiss them as unfounded. On the contrary, Emmett's fieldwork and documentation appear to be more than competent by the standards of his time and should be allowed to stand on their own merit. Typical of many mainstream archaeologists' discussion of other controversial artifacts, they cite speculation and opinion in place of factual evidence to prove the artifact fraudulent. Now, that's interesting. Now, that's a goddamn interesting point right there. Let me repeat that again. I'm going to tell you why this is that's an interesting point and why I think I've come across this myself really recently. Typical of many mainstream archaeologists' discussion of controversial artifacts, they cite speculation and opinion in place of factual evidence to prove the artifacts fraudulent. Now, there was a geologist by the name of Bud Shelton who originally had said that he believed the rock wall was a man-made formation, then backtracked and said, it's too old, it's got to be natural. He got freaked out by how old it was. And there's a long report that he did on the geology of the rock wall, and it's not something that everybody who is not really into that kind of stuff is going to read, because, you know, if you don't really know a lot about that kind of stuff, it's not going to make sense to you. But me being the glutton for fucking punishment that I am, I read the whole thing several times, and what's interesting is that's exactly what he does. That description is exactly what John Lindsay, and I knew someone who actually went and tracked him down a couple of years ago. He lives out in West Texas somewhere. And they went and tracked him down and knocked on his door and asked him about, you know, and I'm talking about that. It's too old. It's a natural formation, blah, 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 blah. But yet in his report on the wall, he states many times the anomalies. He talks about the magnetic anomalies of the wall. He talks about the paleomagnetic survey dating at 55 million years. He talks about the different types of rare earth metals and stones that are comprised of this. He talks about how there's, you know, no other examples of anything like this. But then when he goes to explain why it's a natural formation, all of his explanations to prove why it's not man-made are all speculation on their own right. But that's what people take as scientific fact. And then they accuse people who are trying to bring out real facts, like myself, as being the speculators, but goddammit, these scientists speculate more than anybody. And their speculation is based on a front to lie and cover this stuff up. The authors began by labeling those who take seriously the idea of pre-Columbian contact with the old world as cult archaeologists. This term promotes a negative connotation to the subject matter at the outset. At the time, name-calling strategies undermine objectivity and credibility. Number two, they also undermine their own argument by attempting to associate the Back Creek inscription with other allegedly fraudulent artifacts, such as the Kensington Runestone. I have extensive experience investigating the Minnesota object, which has now been found to be a genuine medieval artifact. The crux of their argument was to accuse John Emmert of faking the inscription to curry favor with his supervisor, Cyrus Thomas. What is also disturbing and unethical in this case is that Emmert's credibility was never questioned, until the 1970s when it was first realized that the inscription was, in fact, Paleo-Hebrew. More recent arguments by archaeologists Mainfort and Quas, who initially argued the inscription was not Hebrew, eventually conceded in 2004 that the inscription was, in fact, Hebrew after all, but insisted that Freemasons must have been responsible for making the inscription. Right, right. Yeah, ancient Freemasons. Freemasons before there was actual masonry around, right? Another recently proposed theory is that the mound was intruded by the Cherokee during the 18th century. The Back Creek Stone was examined on May 28, 2010, using an Olympus SZX-12 zoom microscope with a spot digital camera system transported to the McClung Museum on the University of Tennessee campus. The artifact was again examined on the University of Tennessee campus with a scanning electron microscope on June 29, 2010. I took photographs of the object during the examinations on May 28, 2010 and June 29, 2010. They revealed that the inscribed side of the Back Creek Stone, with nearly all of the dark brown colored, approximately 1 to 2 millimeters thick, iron oxide-rich weathering rind was intact. Areas along the top edge and in the lower right corner have spalled off, exposing the light brown-colored, unweathered, iron-cemented, clayey siltstone. And the upper—that's just so interesting because that just again, I mean, that's what the rock wall was made out of, similar to that. Stuff that's been found around it. And the upper left area are two roughly parallel, approximately 1 centimeter long vertical lines scratched into the stone sometime between 1894 and 1970. The backside of the Back Creek Stone has the original Smithsonian identification names and numbers, virtually all but a few remnants, along the top and bottom edges and along the small arrowhead-shaped portion of the lower right side of approximately 1 to 2 millimeters thick. Iron oxide-rich weathering rind has peeled off, exposing the light brown-colored, unweathered, iron-cemented clay siltstone. The scratch made by Emmert with the metal prod at the time of the excavation is on the far right, and approximately a 27-millimeter-long scratch is present on the far middle right end of the backside of the stone. The long, thinning scratch has relatively sharp and jagged edges and appears to be consistent with contact with a sharp prod, as reported by John Emmert at the time of the discovery. The brittle nature of the deposits within the groove, comprised of greater than 50% clay minerals, with remaining silica material comprised of quartz. So that's interesting. I mean, that's siltstone, quartz, silica, clay. I mean, these are all the same. That blows me away. These are all the same materials that we see in the makeup of the rock wall. And we have these, this Phoenician connection, both with the Back Creek inscription and the rock wall, with the scientist reporting that he'd only seen wall stones like the rock wall in one other place on Earth, and that was when he was excavating Carthage, a Canaanite Phoenician city. The Back Creek inscription was carved into what appears to be a dark brown to light tan colored iron oxide rich clay siltstone concretion. The relatively shallow and rounded shape of the groove suggests that characters were carved with a tool that had a somewhat rounded tip. The iron oxide rich clay siltstone concretion has a dark brown weathering rind that is approximately 1 to 2 millimeters thick. The entire surface of the inscription of the stone was lightly polished, the action of which rounded the edges of the carved grooves of the inscribed characters. This is consistent with the following comment in John Emmert's letter to Cyrus Thomas in his February 15, 1889 letter. In the one with nine in it, found a large pair of copper bracelets and a polished stone with letters or characters cut on it, unlike anything I have ever seen before. The two roughly parallel scratches that were made sometime after 1891 and before January 1971 have sharp and jagged edges. in February 25th, 1889, letter to Cyrus Thomas, John Emmert included a sketch of the inscribed stone that did not include the two roughly parallel scratches on the inscription side. The two roughly parallel scratches are not present in the 1891 photograph, but are present in the stone in 1971. In his March 7th, 1889 letter to Cyrus Thomas, John Emmert wrote that anyone could have worked this mound without leaving some evidence of it. I think it impossible. In his March 7th, 1889 letter to Cyrus Thomas, John Emmert also wrote, the engraved stone was lying just under the back of the skull. I punched it on the rough side with my steel rod in probing it before I came to the skeletons. The other side of the stone is exactly as it was taken from the skeleton at the bottom of the mound, about 5 feet deep. The scratch on the back side of the stone has sharp and jagged edges consistent with an unweathered and unpolished freshly made surface defect. The presence of the fresh scratch made with a metal prod at the time of the discovery on the back side of the artifact indicates that the stone was placed immediately under the skull and jawbones of skeleton number one at the time of burial with the inscription side down. The two roughly parallel, non-weathered and unpolished scratches on the inscribed side of the stone were made sometime between 1891 and 1971, apparently while in the custody of the Smithsonian Institution. Because the profile of the grooves of the original inscription are rounded as opposed to the grooves of the two scratches, which are V-shaped, this would be consistent with the scratches being made with a sharper, more pointed tool. Based on a visual review of the images and the physical properties of the material, it is estimated that the deposits within the groove carved in the dark brown iron-rich weathered rind layer are comprised of greater than 50% clay minerals, with the remaining silt-sized material comprised of quartz. Because we did not observe any of the orange-colored silty clay in the grooves of the inscription, and the overall surface of the stone and the edges of the grooves were polished at the time of discovery, the inscription had to have been made prior to the excavation of the mound by John Emmert. Based upon the results of our investigation, the following sequence of events occurred. The at least nine-character inscription was carved into the dark brown iron-rich siltstone concretion on the side with the weathered rind intact. I feel like I already read this. Why is it? Am I caught in Groundhog Day here? I feel like I already read this. Are they repeating themselves here? It seems like I go to the next page and it says the same shit it said on the page before. This is driving me crazy. Based on our review of the historical correspondence and the reflected light and scanning electron microscope examinations of the artifact on May 28, 2010, the following conclusions are appropriate. Number one, our geological findings are consistent with the Smithsonian Institution's field report written by John W. Emmert. The complete lack of the orange-colored silty clay residue in any of the characters of the inscription is consistent with many hundreds of years of weathering in a wet earth mound comprised of soil and hard red clay. The inscribed stone and all the other artifacts and remains found in the mound with it can be no younger than when the bodies of the deceased were buried inside the mound. These observations validate the artifact's ancient authenticity and tend to support Professor Gordon's conclusions published 40 years ago. He translated the inscription for Judea and dated it to 70 to 135 AD, based on its distinctive letter form. Eastern Tennessee's Back Creek Stone, Gordon stated, is not only the oldest text ever discovered in North America, but more importantly, it is the first time a Mediterranean inscription has been found anywhere in the Western Hemisphere, and its original site with all the original objects connected with it in place. So that's the end of chapter three there, the Back Creek Stone, the Back Creek Inscription. Definitely do some looking up on that and research on that on your own. We'll all be talking about it in the new film as well, The Lost Secrets of Ancient America, Volume 1. TheGlobalReality.com is my website. You can support our films there with a donation. You can support our work here at the radio show to keep the stream going with a donation and to keep me alive and keep me pushing forward with all this. You can also help us out by getting something off of our Amazon wish list, which will help us in our work here as well. TheGlobalReality.com is my website. My name is Josh Reeves. I love each and every one of you, and we'll see you next time. You guys have a great one. Take care.